Ms. Mundy, you may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. I'm Monica Mundy, and I represent Jordan Williams in this medical malpractice appeal, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The central issue in this case concerns the trial court's refusal to give a foreseeable consequences jury instruction. The trial court noted on the record that this was a very important issue for the plaintiff and also commented that whether to give the instruction was essentially a coin toss. It was not a coin toss, but even if it was, we should have won that toss because there was more than a scintilla of evidence to support the instruction, particularly when this court must view the evidence in the light most favorable to the proponent of the instruction, the plaintiff.
May I ask you this? The first sentence of the instruction is, if you find that the doctor or the medical practice, if you find that the doctor or the medical practice was negligent, then he is liable for all consequences of that negligence, whether foreseen or not, period. Obviously, that's not true. You're not strictly liable for all damages simply because you're negligent, foreseeable or not. So my first question to you is, before I even get to the question of scintilla of evidence, it's not a coin toss at all. That's just simply not the law. It never has been the law. It's not in the model jury instruction. They've been thrown around in an opinion here and there, but that doesn't make it a jury instruction.
Your Honor, first of all, this instruction that was tendered in this case was taken both from the model jury instruction. It does not track the language identically.
Well, that's my point. The first sentence is not in 4.018. And that's because the first sentence is on its face incorrect. It's indisputably not the law.
Your Honor, it actually tracks the instruction that this court, although did not explicitly adopt, commented favorably upon in the Blondell case. So it's not
actually
language.
The language is different in the Blondell case.
It is, Your Honor. That is correct. But the introductory language, if you find the defendant was negligent, the reason why that language...
Then he is liable for... all the consequences, it says the consequences that naturally flow. Are those the same?
Those are not identical, Your Honor, but our instruction did use the word all consequences, and the consequences is what it refers to is referring to causation. And then it must be read in conjunction with what the second sentence says. And the second sentence then has the black letter law that we know, which is...
The second sentence is foreseeability. The first sentence is a strict liability finding for damages, all consequences of that negligence, whether foreseeable or not. So we're talking about the entirety of the causal matrix, foreseeable or not, all, not some, all consequences. I mean, tell me I'm wrong if you think I'm wrong, but that statement is not the law. Am I wrong or right?
Your Honor, I think that the consequences does refer to the causation. And it talks about the consequences of the negligence. That's what is the lead-in to this whole concept. The black-letter law is that you don't have to foresee the precise injury caused by your negligence. So we're talking about first the jury has to find that there's negligence. Then we're going to talk about the consequences of those negligence. But the second sentence, if there's any concern about the first sentence, the second sentence certainly clears it up.
If we're using an abuse of discretion standard and a trial judge looks at this, how could we say it? He abused his discretion or she abused her discretion by not giving an instruction which is at best facially wrong and at worst incredibly inconsistent?
Your Honor, first of all, the trial court did not reach that issue. And certainly, though, this court has to determine whether it is a correct statement of law. And the question about whether it was correct statement of law or not was raised for the first time after the writ was granted.
Right result, wrong reason. So what?
But the trial court never had an opportunity to even...
It's a pure question of law as to what that sentence says.
But I think that the way that I would answer this question is, first of all, it correctly instructs the jury that you cannot reach the issue of foreseeable consequences until you find that somebody's negligent. It also then states that the defendant is going to be liable for the consequences of that negligence, but it has to be read in the context of what comes after that.
But what comes after that is wrong on its face, too.
No, Your Honor.
Blondell, if you're following Blondell, it says might probably result from that negligence. This says might result. Aren't those two very different?
They are different, but let me explain why it doesn't matter in this case. And this is a unique aspect of this case. One of the things you have to have as a predicate for this instruction to apply is you have to have some injury that is foreseeable, is a foreseeable consequence of the negligence. We have that in spades. Virtually everybody agreed, including the defendants themselves, that the sustained low blood pressure was a foreseeable cause of the kidney damage that the plaintiff suffered. That's the predicate injury. Then the question, so that was undisputed, literally undisputed. Even Dr. Higdon said, yes, I assumed that it caused it. And we had a defense expert, Dr. Dowd, who said it's so elementary that even a medical student would know it. That's at JA 374. Now, once you get there, then the question becomes the issue that's in this case, which is the spinal nerve root injury that caused paralysis. So the evidence was virtually undisputed, not only that it could, but that it did. Well, that it did, in fact, cause it.
Did the theory of the case by the defendant say, look, I assume that some damage, some injury could have occurred, but not this precise injury? I thought the theory of the defense was the whole theory of causation by the plaintiff's expert is wrong. There's a wholly different explanation of causation. So I thought these instructions were given, and the only time I've ever seen them given is when the defense says, okay, maybe some harm, like what the plaintiff's expert said, could have occurred, but not this specific harm because that's just too weird, and we give the instruction. I don't see that theory in this case.
Your Honor, the theory, the defendants both, their theory was is that it was caused by compression. The paralysis was caused by compression during the surgery.
As opposed to the plaintiff's theory causing some damage, but not this particular damage.
Well, the plaintiff offered, we offered evidence that it was, that both injuries were caused by the sustained low blood pressure. But Dr. Swenson, the orthopedic, also posited a defense that it was not foreseeable. And the defense, now Dr. Swenson will argue, okay, well, I was only arguing that in the context of standard of care. And we have two responses for that. Number one, foreseeability is not an element of the standard of care. That is, standard of care is defined by statute in 801.581.20, which does not reference that. But even if it is, it was clear that what Dr. Swenson was doing is exactly what this instruction is designed to prevent, which is you cannot allow a defendant to avoid liability when he knows that some injury could result from his negligence, but not the precise injury. So if I can, at page 705 of the closing, just to make it clear that Dr. Swenson was using this as a causation argument, not just as a standard of care argument, and this instruction goes to causation. This is what, at the bottom of page 705, the Dr. Swenson's closing argument. Plaintiff did not prove negligence. The law that Judge Fisher has also given is plaintiff must also prove this thing called proximate cause. It means that Dr. Swenson and Ms. Bozarth proximately caused Mr. Williams' injuries. It means that he caused them. We've got to prove that something that Dr. Swenson did or didn't do caused history's first ever cauda equina stroke in a way that he has some reason to anticipate some sort of significant injury to Mr. Williams, and Dr. Swenson should have foreseen and prevented the injuries. That is what the plaintiff has to prove, and how could Dr. Swenson have done so? Why would he predict history's first ever event of this kind?
But isn't that actually exactly what you're saying? The defense is not the difference between some injury versus this precise injury, it's but for causation of some injury. And there's a proximate cause instruction that was given that was mentioned in the finding instruction. So I'm not seeing the analytical disparity between the argument you keep pointing to and your instruction, because the some versus precise is not the debate they're having with you.
But my point which I hope I'm making, is that the point in this case is that it was just undisputed that the sustained low blood pressure caused the kidney problem. And so we have the sum injury, undisputed. Not only that it could have or would have or should have or likely would, everybody admitted that.
So they said you had to prove that. And your whole point is, in this instruction, that's all I had to prove. I don't have to prove anything more. And they're looking at you like, so?
Well, but we did also, Your Honor, we also had expert testimony from Dr. Kramer and Dr. Saltzman that the sustained low blood pressure also caused the paralysis and the catecholamine injury. So this we didn't leapfrog over any type of evidentiary requirement. Further, this the court has said that you have to look at all the instructions as a whole. And so there were four other instructions that instructed the jury on proximate cause. At JA 74, we have the issues instruction, which said you have to find if there's a standard of care and a breach, you have to find if there's causation, and then you have to find damages. At JA 79, we have the definition of proximate cause. At JA 80, we have the binding instruction, which again indicated you shall find your verdict if you have found it clearly requires causation. And then at JA 83, also talks about when an employer is liable for damages caused by the negligence of the employee. So the argument that, well, this means that you skipped causation, we disagree with that when viewing the instructions as a whole and looking at this instruction as a whole as well. Now, a related argument has been made by the defense as well, Your Honor, which is, well, the jury didn't find that there was negligence, so we can't even reach this particular instruction. This was a general verdict, so we do not know on what grounds the jury decided this case. And given this court's case law, I think we have to assume that it was because this important issue of Virginia law was not given to the jury. So what happened is that Dr. Swenson was able to get up in closing and argue the very thing that Blondell says that this instruction is designed to prevent.
What you just read, was that the closing argument section?
That was closing argument.
Okay. Tell me why I'm wrong. I heard you read that, and I've read it several times before today. I'm looking at it right now. I read that to them to be saying, okay, they've got to prove there's some injury. They got to prove causation. I don't read that for them to say, look, it's not enough for them to prove some injury. They got to prove the exact precise cause of the damage, which is the reason we give that instruction, to keep people from saying that, because that's not the law either. So what am I missing? I'm obviously missing something from your perspective. What is it?
Well, I'm not sure, Your Honor, and maybe I'll think about it to see if I can answer it better on rebuttal, but basically we proved breach of the standard of care. We proved causation of both injuries through Kramer and through Dr. Saltzman.
All true, prima facie.
Right, and then we proved damage. And what happened was Dr. Swenson was able to get up and say, just because I couldn't foresee the precise injury, because nobody's seen this happen before as a result of low blood pressure, I'm off the hook. That's exactly what he's not allowed to do.
Would you like to save the remainder of your time?
Yes, thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Jonathan Traub, and I represent Dr. Swenson. My co-appellee, who is a different party, but has kindly ceded me 9 minutes to try and cover what needs to be covered here. Your Honor, the appellants have the entire issue of foreseeability wrong on so many levels. To begin with, at no point during the trial of this case, in evidence or argument, did anyone suggest that Dr. Swenson, if he was found liable for negligence, right, and if for negligence in not treating the blood pressure, and if the jury believed that the blood pressure caused the catecholamine stroke, that Dr. Swenson should not be liable because he couldn't foresee that injury. Nobody argued that. That was not our position at all. We argued, I was not trial counsel, but we argued that foreseeability related to two issues in this case. One, the standard of care, really unforeseeability, the standard of care. No one had ever seen or heard of the plaintiff's theory of causation causing this injury. It wasn't reported in any medical literature.
How does that fit into the standard of care?
I'm sorry, sir?
How does that fit into the standard of care?
Because the standard of care...
I mean, it's implicit in the standard of care, because I assume a doctor would, in making decisions on how to treat somebody, would take keep in mind what the likely problems are. But other than that, it's not in our... And it's not in our literature, is it?
Oh, no. I disagree. Inherent in the standard of care, the definition of the standard of care is what would a reasonably prudent physician do under the same or similar circumstances?
I agree, but we don't use the term foreseeability when we're talking about standard of care.
No, you don't use the term, but the concept is absolutely central. If nobody has ever seen this before in this context, it is at least reasonable to suggest to a jury that they consider that in determining whether a reasonably prudent physician would be required to consider or deal with this.
Might that not confuse a jury, though, because we're also using foreseeability for causation?
Well, we're actually not using it for causation the way the plaintiff says, and that's a critical point in this, which is the second way we used it. But to say that unforeseeability is not an element of standard of care, to me, defies absolute basic common sense.
Well, it would be if the issue was informed consent. If something's not foreseeable at all, well, how are you going to inform somebody that they might have it occur? I get that.
Right.
But why is Justice Millett incorrect in dividing, as so many cases have, standard of care and causation?
Well, they are different, but let me just make sure the court understands our position here. When it comes to causation, there were two absolutely separate theories of causation, just like in Blundell, two irreconcilably different theories of causation. We used the issue of unforeseeability to, just as Kelsey said in an earlier argument, to chip away at the plaintiff's case, to make it less likely that their theory of causation is plausible. Again, if nobody's ever heard of this causing, your theory causing this problem, at least it could reasonably put a doubt in the jury's mind that this theory of causation is true. Our theory of causation is more plausible. That's what we used it for. It's purely impeachment.
But this is different from Blondell, because in Blondell there was no other injury. In this case, we've got another injury.
Well, it depends. Again, Your Honor, it depends on what you call an injury. The issue with
respect, damage to kidneys is an injury, is it not?
It completely resolved. With no, with
doesn't make it less of an injury, does it?
Well, it's no different than saying a patient after surgery runs a fever, and then the fever resolves, or the patient after surgery has any number of transient complications, which then resolve, are not sued upon, seek no damages on account of. The way the kidney issue was used at trial by the plaintiff was as a red flag for the injury they were asserting. They were saying that because you had a transient kidney injury, you should have then been on notice and foreseen the fact that there was going to be further complications, including progressive paralysis. That's what Dr. Lippman, their plaintiff's expert, said. You should have foreseen this. They sought no relief because of a transient kidney problem.
See, it seemed to me what they were saying was because you were aware of the probability or possibility, perhaps, of kidney damage, then the standard of care is that you treated that blood pressure issue, and if you'd done that, then he wouldn't have had the paralysis that he ended up with.
They're saying had you conducted the correct investigation, you would have and called in the correct specialist, from their point of view, you would have been alerted to the fact that the ultimate injury here was on the table, and you could have, as Dr. Lippman put it in the transcript, nipped it in the bud.
I don't think so. I think what they're saying was standard of care in this case required even a medical student to know that low blood pressure could cause kidney damage. Therefore, the standard of care is you treat that low blood pressure, and just because some other injury happened doesn't mean you're not liable for that injury. Isn't that what they're saying?
No, I don't think so. I don't. I don't. I don't think so.
Well, Ms. Mundy will tell us.
I don't believe so. The issue of foreseeability here, or unforeseeability, was never used in the context of proximate causation except to discredit their theory of proximate causation. That's the only reason it got used. Right? Nobody said that Dr. Swenson shouldn't be liable if you believe their theory of causation, right? And if you find that he was negligent in not treating blood pressure. Had somebody relied on that argument, then an unforeseeability instruction would have been appropriate. Even so, how can it conceivably be an abuse of discretion for a judge not to give an instruction that is three generations removed from the standard instruction? And that is, in fact, incorrect, in not just in minor ways, but in extremely substantial ways, without, by the way, alerting the court in any way that they had modified the...
The instruction said that if the defendant was negligent, he's liable for all consequences.
Yes.
Period.
Yeah,
whether foreseeable, unforeseeable,
doesn't
matter.
That's not the law. That's not the law. It can't be the law. It's a strict liability statute, a liability for damages provision. It's not what Blondell said. The Blondell opinion says all consequences which naturally flow. The concept of natural flow fits into the proximate cause instruction, which talks about natural and continuous sequence. What this instruction does at best, if it's given, is create a conflict between this instruction and the proximate cause instruction. The jury goes back and they say, well, can we find him liable for all consequences, or does it have to be what the other instruction says, consequences which naturally and continuously flow? At best, it is a confusing instruction. It is certainly within the province of the court to decide that this is not a proper instruction to give in the context of this case. If the court reviews Dr. Lippman, who was the standard of care expert against Dr. Swenson, Dr. Lippman said the issue was not that this is a second unforeseeable injury. Dr. Lippman said, you should have been aware of this injury. If you had done the right job, you would have been aware of this, you could have addressed it, and the damage would have been nipped in the bud. That does not raise unforeseeability the way that Blondell talked about it. We have the parallel situation in Blondell, as in Blondell. We have two irreconcilable theories of causation. We say
you are now into another party's time.
Oh, I am. I am. I do want to have an opportunity to talk about the closing argument, and I will just say...
Well, I'm not. Your time is up. You all allocate the time, and we calculate it.
May it please the Court. Ron Herbert on behalf of Dr. Higdon and Tidewater Physicians Multispecialty Group. Essentially, I have the hospitalists. And the reason that it's important for my client is you have to really kind of look at the only issue that's relevant to him. The only issue relevant to him is whether or not the instruction is appropriate. Counsel for the plaintiff has conceded in her reply brief that the closing argument issue does not apply. It's on page 11 of her reply brief. Assignment of Error 3 does not apply to Dr. Higdon.
Was there a motion for mistrial during the closing argument?
No, sir.
Was there a motion for a cautionary instruction?
No, sir. And, but again, I was actually the only counsel here who tried the case. And the issue then becomes, what I also find very interesting in this case is that they tendered four separate foreseeability instructions, one for each individual defendant. So the court had before it two for Mr. Schraub's clients and two for my clients. The court could have granted either one or not. As to my clients, this now comes down to the single issue is, was it appropriate for foreseeability? I never argued foreseeability. I never presented it as a defense. It was never put on any evidence by any expert or any party in the case as to the care of the hospitals. And the reason we went through in our brief and laid out the two treatment periods is it is very important. You have to look at the context of my client. He comes on 20 hours after the surgery. The claim against the orthopedist was, for 20 hours, they didn't treat the blood pressure. For 20 hours, they didn't, as Mr. Muneer counsel for Dr. Swenson at trial said, they didn't turn the hose up, in other words, to raise the blood pressure up. That was their claim against them. So my client comes in, he's consulted for that very reason, because the next morning after surgery, they recognize that his electrolytes are low, which is an indication of acute renal failure. So when my client comes in, the patient's already in acute renal failure. So he knows he's got to raise the blood pressure. That's exactly what he does. Gives fluids, stops the high blood pressure medications, and those were all the appropriate things to do, which even their own expert, Dr. Salzman, said those were appropriate things to do. So the issue then as to Dr. Higdon and the hospitalist was not whether there was foreseeable injury. The issue was whether their treatments to raise the blood pressure were sufficient. Their expert conceded the treatments were sufficient to raise the blood pressure enough to cure the renal failure, and everyone agreed the renal failure was cured. There was no sequelae from it. Then the only issue became the causation issue as to which theory the jury understood as to my client as to whether it was from the positioning during surgery or whether it was from low blood pressure, which again had already been going on for 20-some hours prior to when my client was ever brought into the case. In fact, originally they claimed that the pressure was low during surgery, which is almost 5 hours, but they settled out with the hospital and the anesthesiologist. So really 25 hours before my client ever comes into the case is when this low blood pressure comes, which they say caused all the injury and caused all the damage. So when it comes down to the simple process here, the simple issue of what was the issue against the hospitalists, it's solely, was this instruction proper? Then we go back to Holmes versus Levine, and there are two things that Holmes versus Levine tells us. There's got to be sufficient evidence to support the instruction. There was no evidence as to foreseeability as to my client. I didn't present it. I didn't argue it in closing. They didn't raise it. And even Mr. Muneer, when he argued his closing, didn't talk about foreseeability as to the hospitalists. He only talked about it as to foreseeability of the orthopedists. And I took in my brief and went through specifically all of the places where the experts talked about foreseeability in it. Every one of those referred to the orthopedist, either Dr. Swenson or Ms. Bozarth, the PA. No one and nowhere near was there any argument that the hospitalist should have or could have foreseen the issues. Then, the second part of Hamsel versus Levin, I couldn't argue better than Justice Kelsey, Justice McClellan just did. It is an incorrect statement of law. I was trial counsel there. I did get this tendered instruction, which cited Blondell versus Hayes. It didn't say it was modified. I will be honest with the court, I didn't recognize it at the time. It wasn't until I got on appeal that I recognized that they had removed operative words of which naturally flow and probably result. I was under the impression it was the same language in Blondell because that's what was represented to me. Again, that's a whole lot of separate issue. But the point being is, was an abuse of the
discretion. Can I interrupt you for a second? Having been at trial, do you remember if there was ever any caveated acknowledgement that, you know, we've paraphrased it a little bit, Judge, but it's the same thing as Blondell, or was it always, no, we just literally lifted it verbatim from Blondell?
Your Honor, I don't think there was a comment either way. All I know was what was tendered. If you look at it, so it's the instruction says to my client are J91 and J103, but it, at the bottom it just has the cite for Blondell. Normally, if I had something in there and I modified it, I would put modified next to it. So
the trial judge probably thought this was a verbatim quote from Blondell, and Blondell doesn't say all consequences.
Right, and you're correct. The way this is written is a strict liability instruction, which is not the law. So is it an abuse of discretion? No. There's no evidence against my client, and the instruction they tendered is an incorrect statement of the law. So under both prongs of Holmes, as to my client, they failed. I come as an appellee, hopefully in the best, most favorable position. I would like to stay that way. I would appreciate if the court would sustain the ruling as to my client and not make him sit through 2 weeks of trial again.
I understand.
Thank you very much.
I have a few points, Your Honor. First, let me address the kidney issue, because the argument's been made that, you know, it was a pretext of somehow to support this instruction. The kidney injury was real, it was sustained, and it resulted in the plaintiff going into kidney failure and having to go in the ICU after a hip replacement surgery. Second, the plaintiff's expert, Dr. Lippman, actually testified that as to Dr. Swenson, that the paralysis and the nerve root injury were not fully foreseeable. That testimony came at the JA 174-5 and 181. He said he could not have foreseen it. So that evidence is there. Finally, on Blondell, the problem with Blondell and the reason why the instruction wasn't applicable in that case is because the plaintiff had no theory in that case that involved an unforeseeable result. The plaintiff's theory was that it was meconium toxicity that caused the death of the mother and her child. So that's different from our case. Here we have an unforeseeable result, which is the spinal nerve root injury and the paralysis.
May I ask you the same question I just asked? Was the trial judge ever put on notice that the instruction, which has Blondell as a site on it, is actually not from Blondell, and critical language has been changed, which makes it go from being a correct interpretation of law to a facially incorrect interpretation of law?
Your Honor, my recollection of the transcript is that there was absolutely no discussion at all about the language of the instruction. It was all about whether it applied.
Doesn't that hurt you? I mean, it seems to me a trial judge, any trial judge, would read the first sentence and say, well, I don't need to read any cases. I know strict liability is not the damage formulation in Virginia law. Isn't it very likely the trial judge assumed what was written there was a quote from Blondell, since Blondell is the site used on the very instruction, and it's obviously not?
Not at all, Your Honor. And I mean, when I was trying cases, I would put case authority as, you know, if you had case citation, it was case authority. It didn't mean that the language came directly from that case. But the transcript reflects that there was no discussion about the language of the instruction.
All right, your time has expired.